Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. So this week, I want to take a look at maybe like imaginary monsters, these sort of fears that are conjured up by the ruling elite of the United States and perhaps some other Western nations as they try to navigate through the world and like imagine possible threats. The immediate spur to this is the sort of release of a finding from the United States National Security that they've concluded that Havana Syndrome, actually that is not real. And this is a topic that had taken up a lot of press over the last few years. The claim that there was some foreign foe of the United States, possibly Cuba, Russia, China. It was never quite decided on who it was that had created a super weapon that was causing American diplomats and military officials and intelligence officials to suddenly have injuries. And the findings are sort of respectful, but maybe in the sense that one would do to a patient suffering from a psychosomatic illness. Like, yes, we respect your experience. Everything you say you felt is true, but actually we can't actually find a medical basis for this. And so to talk about this, I think the Havana Syndrome story is a good example of what one might call the psychosomosis of empire, the way in which an imperial anxiety can lead the elite to not just sort of conjure up fears, but actually also believe them. And it's far from the only example in recent years. And to talk about this, I'm very happy to have on Branko Marchtich, who is a writer for Jacobin, and who wrote about both Havana Syndrome and the other examples of sort of threat inflation that have existed. So we can just start by rehearsing what was Havana Syndrome, and why have we now concluded that it never actually existed?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. Havana Syndrome was a series of, I think they call them anomalous health incidents. That's the kind of official parlance in the intelligence community, quote unquote. And so it was a bunch of different health symptoms that cropped up around, I believe, first in the embassy, the U.S. embassy in Cuba, among diplomats and intelligence agents. But then once news about it came to light and it became kind of a big deal in the news, you started to see this get people experiencing it, all over the world, in various U.S. government buildings, various embassies around the world among diplomats, not just in Cuba. I think actually by the end, I remember there were Serbian diplomats who were feeling it, and Serbia is not exactly anymore kind of a geopolitical adversary of the United States. So this is sort of cropping up everywhere. And I think it points to what you were talking about there, which is that a lot of the stuff was almost certainly psychosomatic. It was stuff that through the power of suggestion and through the power of the mind, through the power of anxiety and psychological stress and all these different things, that people were sort of almost willing these symptoms into existence, which doesn't mean that they weren't feeling them, but it does mean that the culprit was not necessarily some high-tech microwave weapon that some ne'er-do-well supervillain was blasting at people, but more an internal psychological problem, which we can go into that a little bit, but may point to a certain level of imperial anxiety or perhaps even some sort of perhaps guilt or other emotional L adjustments among the people who are, basically running U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, one can even to cite historical examples. I mean, I think it's pretty well documented that a lot of the people, who were in the CIA in the original years of the 1940s and 50s and 60s, they sort of self-medicated, whether through alcohol or other, pharmaceutical aids. And it, it doesn't take much to imagine that if you're day-to-day job involves, torture and alliances with criminals and all sorts of unsavory activities, you might deal with that. And then one can see sort of Havana syndrome as a continuity with this issue, that there is a sort of psychological damage that comes from being an agent of empire. But we'll get to that more in a bit. But one thing your piece brings up, which I want to underscore, is that the media was very credulous about this. Not all the media. On a previous podcast, I had on Natalie Scherr from The New Republic, and who wrote a very good piece a few years ago, just, casting skeptical doubt on it. But I think among the more mainstream media, there was a lot of reporting that just took Havana syndrome at face value, as if there was a super weapon out there. We just have to find the culprit, and which is all the more amazing because like as people pointed out at the time, such a super weapon would have to like violate sort of known laws of physics. We don't actually have any way of conceiving of how such a weapon would work based on existing science.
Yeah, I mean, you would also think that it might be used by one of these malevolent governments in, say, a war that they were fighting, perhaps the war in Ukraine, right? I mean, if Russia was one of the governments that was accused at various points, because it's, as you mentioned, it's cycled through a number of different kind of villains, U.S. villains, who are supposed to be responsible for this. Russia was one of them at one point. You would think if they had this great technology, they would be using it in Ukraine, particularly if it doesn't require artillery, and apparently it could be launched from great distances. You would think that would be quite helpful for them, given some of the struggles that they're having fighting this war. But the fact that it wasn't was, I think, one more kind of nail in the coffin for this narrative. Unfortunately, there is a tendency in the press to take anything that comes out of the mouth of a government official as basically fact, which I'm not saying that government officials and intelligence officials are always lying. But I mean, given the track record, we have to think about, what happened with the Iraq war, let alone so many other things since then. I mean, so many things just in the last few years where we've been told certain things by anonymous government officials, and then they turn out not to be true. You would think that this would inspire a little more caution among journalists to not just sort of rush to print, we've been told by three anonymous people that this is the case, and so that must be true. I wish that people took a little more of a skeptical perspective when they were told this stuff. And I mean, I'm being a little bit hard on the media when I write about this stuff, because it wasn't the entirety of the media that kind of swallowed this uncritically. Besides, you mentioned Natalie Scherr, and there's definitely been a lot of kind of independent media that has been pretty skeptical of this. But and there's also been more mainstream press outlets that have also done good work, and that have are part of the reason why we were able to kind of with more finality say, okay, this is probably not true. I think about BuzzFeed. They put out that piece, whatever it was, two years ago, maybe 3 years ago, where they wrote about the State Department report that determined the actual Havana syndrome, the actual microwave weapon was actually just the sound of crickets that people in the embassies were hearing. So, you know, so there is, it does exist, but the problem is, you know, and I've compiled this in a previous piece before this most recent one I wrote. You can go back, set your Google time to, you know, whatever, 2017 to 2019, look up Havana syndrome. You'll see that there's just umpteen headlines and pieces that blast out, you know, microwave weapon used to attack Americans as if it's just settled fact, when in actual fact it was basically just hearsay that was being repeated and that was being basically laundered by the press unwittingly.
Yeah, that's right. And as you mentioned, Havana syndrome is not the only one. And there's a few other examples one could bring up. The one I want to sort of just highlight right now is the sort of bombing of the Nord Stream pipeline. Just because we've seen a very interesting kind of trajectory that, and it's sort of breaking news in terms of, like when the bombing first happened, there's all sorts of, you know, debate as to who could have done it. And there was a prominent line that was put forward that Russia itself did this, which, like, just on a logical level, like, didn't make a lot of sense. Like why would Russia bomb its own pipeline? Like it would be, you know, as if, like, you know, Joe Biden decided to, you know, pull up the pipelines in North Dakota and Alaska. The famed investigative reporter Seymour Hersh came out with a piece that got a lot of attention. It was very controversial, citing sources that claimed that it was an operation that was ordered by the U.S. government and carried out by intelligence agencies. And there was a lot of, you know, questions raised about that. Well, there was only one kind of source that was named supposedly, who was like kind of anonymous. The way Hersh works is he tries to give you the minimum of sources because he talks to a lot of people. But you know, like in that, you know, there's like one kind of quoted source in addition to whoever else he talked about, and it's all anonymous. Yeah. And there were other issues raised about that reporting. But one of the interesting consequences of his reporting is that suddenly, you know, a few weeks later, the New York Times comes up with an article also based on anonymous intelligence sources that says, there's some concern that the bombing was done by what is bizarrely described as a pro-Ukrainian group that is not beholden to President Zelensky or anyone in the Ukrainian government, which might have received training at some point from other unnamed sources. No. The one thing, I mean, we can raise all sorts of questions about this New York Times report as we should, but I think that one thing to mark is that it's a definite break from the narrative that Russia did it. Like now we're saying, okay, Russia did it. It moved to, well, now it's like some amorphous group that went rogue, but not Russia, and was doing it for the pro-Ukrainian side. What do you make of all this?
Well, yeah, number one, among the reasons why it didn't make sense that it was Russia is that it's not just that it's its own infrastructure, though of course it is. Nord Stream was a key part of their leverage over Europe. I mean, Putin had already turned off the gas as part, you know, as a response to the sanctions against them, and if you blow it up and you can no longer, you know, have that kind of carrot of potentially turning the gas back on, you've completely demolished your own leverage. So for that reason, it made no sense among the ones that you quite correctly listed. I mean, in terms of this reporting, it's deeply bizarre. It's very difficult to know what to make of it. You know, at the end of the day, which version of the story you believe may come down to who you trust more. Do you trust Seymour Hersh, who has definitely gotten a lot of stuff right, and who has, you know, had some stuff in the past that maybe was a little more dubious, but nevertheless, you know, what has been called all sorts of names and smeared and labeled a liar for stories that ended up being completely true, like the My Lai massacre, or do you believe US intelligence, which, you know, I think had a bit of a success last year when they kind of predicted the Russian invasion, although I think the story about that is a little more complicated. We can maybe talk about that later. But besides that one instance, has a very spotty record. And even over the course of this war in Ukraine, have quite openly said that, you know, officials have told NBC, oh, by the way, sometimes when we give information, you know, classified intelligence to the press, it's not actually intelligence. We actually don't know if it's true, and it actually might just be stuff that could happen rather than stuff that is happening. So there's a lot of weirdness in this. I mean, I think it's also worth mentioning how that New York Times report, and by the way, I at this point take no real strong position on what exactly is true and what isn't. I think it's possible for there to be bits of truth in all of these different versions, and for them to be wrong in other ways. I also think it's completely possible for Hirsch to be completely right. I think you know, we there needs to be some sort of government investigation, ideally, to actually get to bottom of it.
But, well, I would actually add that in a lot of ways, I mean, if you read the New York Times article closely, it is compatible with much of what is also in Hirsch.
Absolutely.
One way to read the New York Times article is that it's basically, you know, saying that there was a group that was perhaps trained by, you know, NATO or American intelligence agencies and might have taken this initiative on their own, but had, like, you know, prior support or whatever. Or it could just be what, in, you know, intelligence is often called a limited hangout. Like, it's a kind of, you know, provisional excuse, a provisional story you have to keep away from the real story. It's a little bit of truth that you offer in lieu of giving the whole truth.
Yeah, well, but even this version of the truth, I mean, the amount of hedging and kind of qualifying going on in the New York Times report almost makes it, you know, you read it and you go, well, hold on, so is any of this even true? I mean, you know, it's like, well, this is all preliminary information. This might be the case. We're not totally sure. Some of this suggests that this is the case. By the way, you can't see any of this intelligence. You just have to trust us. So it's very difficult to know what to believe. You know, your question about Russia, you know, to me, this points to how this is so dangerous, and how this kind of practice of the way that the press is kind of uncritically accepts and then regurgitates stuff that officials tell them, you know, how perilous it can be. I mean, if people had really believed that Russia had done this attack, what that would have meant was, I mean, in Hirsch's report, he quite correctly says, you know, an attack on German energy infrastructure, that's an act of war. That's an act of war against a NATO state. I mean, thankfully, nothing came of this. But if people had really taken this Russia story and run with it, it could have led to something really disastrous. It could have led to, you know, a direct NATO-Russia conflict, for instance. I mean, the people who were saying this were not, you know, minor figures, and they weren't even anonymous. I mean, there's a great supercut that Matt Orfler did, where he kind of compiled all these people in cable news making this case, you know, just without any evidence, blaming Russia. And it was people like John Brennan, you know, the former CIA director, and a bunch of other national security officials and politicians who were just making this case. In other words, you know, this was the most dangerous kind of misinformation you can possibly imagine. And it wasn't coming from Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or, you know, random accounts, random social media users. It was coming from the highest levels of the US government. And it was being broadcast through cable news, which millions of people, you know, in the US and around the world trust, sometimes even treat as gospel. And you know, that could have led to something really, really bad. Thankfully, it didn't. And now we're sort of left in this position where we're going, you know, now we're being fed a bunch of stories that to me don't make a lot of sense. I mean, the most recent one was this Times piece, which says that, well, actually, it was a private Ukrainian actor, unconnected to the government, even though all these investigators were saying after it happened, you know, in the last, you know, over the last whatever, you know, 5-6 months, It was a state actor. It was almost certainly a government that did this. We don't know who, but it must have been a government. Now they're saying, actually, no, the entire time they knew it was a private actor that was connected to no government, but they couldn't say that because they were trying to protect Ukraine. Well, okay, if they were trying to protect Ukraine, how does it make more sense to say it was a government if the reality is it wasn't a government? It doesn't. None of it makes a lot of sense. I think is the conclusion I come to, and probably anyone listening to this will.
Yeah, no. So we've gone from a sort of threat inflation of blaming it on Russia to this kind of nonsensical story, which doesn't make sense. Which even if you take it on its own face value, like if there is a sort of private Ukrainian group that is blowing up pipelines, then actually isn't it in the interest of the United States and of NATO to locate that group and to stop it because they're like escalating a war? Of which, Joe Biden, among others, has acknowledged, escalation would be a very terrible thing and could lead to a global catastrophe. So it just like it, anyways. So I think that along with the Havana syndrome, it seems like this the trajectory of the Nord Stream story does show the way in which the sort of misinformation complex that's coming out of the intelligence world and its media accomplices, like it does a lot of harm. Do you want to mention like a few other?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Greatest hits of like so some of these other things that have happened in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, well, just most recently, we had this panic about the Chinese spy balloons. Number one, what we were told was that the initial spy balloon, which was a spy balloon, but the initial spy balloon was the Chinese spy balloon was deliberately sent over the U.S. mainland as a sort of provocation and possibly as a test to see what the U.S. would do. And then after that, the week after that, we had three more objects that were supposed to be Chinese spy balloons that were blasted out of the sky by U.S. fighter jets. Then we find out shortly after those objects are blown up. Number one, officials start telling the Washington Post, well, actually, it wasn't that we just learned about the balloon, a few days before it entered U.S. airspace. We were actually tracking it the entire time from the point that it left the Chinese base. Number two, also, we're pretty sure it was blown off course, and it did not mean to go into the U.S. mainland. It was an accident. So completely
Which is
contradicting
what the
what.
Chinese, which is, by the way, what the Chinese government maintained all along. But good, continue,
Yeah,
yes.
exactly. And it completely contradicts what everyone was saying just before then. Then we find out that Biden does a speech, and he admits, oh, these balloons that we blast, or these objects that we blasted out of the sky, which, by the way, thank God no one was hurt, because one of the missiles that they fired missed the balloon and thankfully just landed in water harmlessly. But you could imagine a million different scenarios where that could have gone much, much worse. He says, oh, actually, no, these they're not a Chinese, nor are they spy balloons. In fact, they're probably just sort of commercial and research balloons. In fact, they may well have been hobbyist balloons, which retail for as little as what, $12, that they may have been firing at. I mean, absolutely ridiculous. But that shows you how, in this number one, in this climate of, I think, national security hysteria, and then number two, when we just sort of take officials' words at face value, how quickly this can ramp up into some really reckless and rash actions on behalf of US officials. Now, okay, let me give you some other ones. I mean, a classic one was the Russian bounty story. Maybe people don't remember this. This was back in 2020, 2019. The claim was that Russia was paying the Taliban money to kill US soldiers. A story that didn't make a lot of sense. I mean, the Taliban don't need a financial incentive to kill U.S. soldiers, number one. Also interesting to think about the outrage about that story, in light of US involvement in this war in Ukraine and how much further it's gone than just sort of paying bounties. But in any case, that story was around for months. And eventually, you know, the commander of the forces in Afghanistan said, I see no evidence of this happening. And yet, even so, I remember very distinctly watching MSNBC a long time after this was debunked. And I was still seeing anchors like Rachel Maddow and others saying that this was this was just basically the case, ignoring the denials from US military officials. You know, there was a story back when Trump was trying to foment war with Iran. There was a story about how Iran was you know, trying to assassinate, I think, a US diplomat in South Africa. And then South Africa eventually denied that story was real. Around the same time, there was, you know, Iran was pinned for a bombing of a I think a US a ship. That also later was a story in the Associated Press that later was also rolled back. I mean, you know, you could go down the line. Actually, just recently, right, we had this story about how China was preparing to send weapons to Ukraine, to Russia to support its war, and that would be a significant story. It would be a significant development, a major escalation in the war potentially. And the US was preparing sanctions. There was a lot of talk about this. And then just quietly, you know, a few days ago, we're once again told that, well, actually, US officials don't really see the evidence that China's actually going to do this. And they're not actually sure if that was really ever on the table. But it's, you know, maybe just saying that they heard it from Russian officials. So, you know, again, a piece of, you know, reporting or supposed intelligence that could have led to, you know, something pretty drastic and potentially disastrous, that ultimately we were told is not as firm, firmly based on reality as we were told initially.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you brought the Taliban bounty hunters thing, because it shows how a lot of this stuff operates, which is you throw mud on the wall and some of it sticks. Even it sticks after the refutation. Like, if you have enough stories about, you know, scary things happening, it doesn't matter that, like, you know, weeks later there's like a correction on page A30. Oh, by the way, you know, that was not right. They don't get the same amount of you know, viral traction. And then it does seem it's a kind of like a method. So I mean, like, at the start of the podcast, we had kind of started with you know, the sort of psychological explanation, which I think in the case of Havana syndrome seems to be on par, but there is also, like, you know, very much a kind of something that's not coming out of the unconscious, but of the conscious, of deliberate propaganda, and of the uses of these kind of historical stories to push certain policies. So, I mean, do you want to say something about that? Like what seems to be, like, being pushed along?
Well, it's always difficult to say conclusively, or you know, to say this is all being done because it's deliberate lies, or this is something that actually people really believe and they're just wrong. I feel like it's often varying mixes of the two, and I think, I mean, I think that the spy balloon example is kind of a good illustration of that, because I don't think US officials want to be flying fighter jets over US airspace, firing missiles that potentially could miss and land God knows where, wasting missiles that cost, what, $400,000 to destroy hobbyist balloons that cost a tiny fraction of that. So that shows that there is a level of actual genuine kind of hysteria and sort of cognitive distortion going on. But it's also true that, you know, among officials, you know, whether it's elected people in Congress or members of the so-called intelligence community, or, you know, whoever else in the gigantic sprawling national security state that exists in the United States, there are people who do want to stoke conflict with you know, these various adversarial governments, and feeding intelligence, however dubious it might be. And you know, it may not be that they're completely making it up, but maybe that this is just sort of some hearsay that they picked up. Maybe that there's just sort of, you know, they've gotten something inconclusive, but hey, it exists. And if it serves that purpose, then why not give it to the press? You know, and some of these people may well believe that really that this is a pressing matter, and that there is a real threat, and you know that they're trying to alert the public about something that they think they ought to know. You know, I don't want to say it's all completely cynical, but you know, I think what it amounts to, though, all of it creates a kind of momentum of its own that once it gets going, I think it's, unless you have people, sensible people, whether in government or the press or, you know, politics more broadly, kind of saying, okay, hold the phone. Let's just back up a second, take a breath, slow down, and let's not, you know, jump to conclusions. I think unless you have those kinds of voices, it's very easy for things to just get out of control. And you know, for this, what starts off as threat inflation to become a real threat, as I think, unfortunately, that's sort of what we're seeing now, where all these stories about China and how threatening it is, and how you know it's doing all this malevolent stuff, and so therefore something has to be done to put a stop to it. It's leading to very real tensions between the US and China, and very real diplomatic spats that are difficult to sort of undo once they get started. So you know, I think that's, if I was to leave people with one thing, that would be a key thing. You know, threat inflation can very quickly, but you know, turn into a very real threat. And then by the end of, you know, God knows whatever that leads to, you look back and you go, well, what the hell? Why did we start all this? It was over a bunch of fake stories and sort of overinflated claims being made by anonymous officials. How what a ridiculous reason to, you know, stoke a conflict that's been so disastrous.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think what I would underline from your analysis is, you know, like motives are often mixed. And it's just the case that the people who would go into the national security state, and especially intelligence, have inherently sort of suspicious mindsets. And, you know, one can see this like in the history, in terms of the Cold War, that, you know, a figure like James Jesus Angleton did believe that a lot of these defectors that he tortured were in fact Russian spies. I mean, he was sincere in his belief, but it just happens that his paranoid disposition made him rise in his occupation and made him successful and led him down this a bad path. Just the same as, you know, people like Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson did believe that there's a, you know, loss in Vietnam would lead to a domino effect, the people in the Bush administration did believe on some level that, you know, like Saddam Hussein represented a wider threat, whether they specifically believed in the weapons of mass destruction or not. But I mean, like, that belief can be coupled with threat inflation and be coupled with a sort of, you know, unwillingness to practice diplomacy or to look for other options. And like, I think all these patterns go hand in hand. The only thing I would emphasize, though, is like, I mean, there's been so many of these stories recently, and they're so outlandish that it almost seems like there's a kind of search for a threat. Like there's a kind of desire for a threat to, you know, justify America's place in the world. And I, you know, there's an article that appeared in Foreign Affairs in 2020 that was partially written by Jake Sullivan, who's now a high official in the Biden administration, and talks about the desirability of what they call a Sputnik moment. The notion of a new Sputnik moment, one that galvanizes public research as powerfully as seeing the Soviet Union launch the world's first satellite did, would be something that would be help restore American economic and technological leadership. Now, and what I find perhaps a little bit pathetic is that if you're searching for a new Sputnik moment, you know, like Sputnik was a real achievement. Like it was a real thing that the Soviets put up, you know, this satellite, you know, like really advanced rocketry and, you know, human exploration of space. And as against, you know, the real development of Sputnik, which did galvanize American science and research and global leadership, now we have things like Havana syndrome and things like balloons. You know, like I feel like a balloon is inherently less threatening than a satellite. That just means it's almost something a little bit pathetic about the type of Sputniks that they're trying to generate.
We must not allow a balloon gap, Mr. President.
Yeah. You laugh, but that was literally an article in the Wall Street Journal that they yeah. quoted think tankers of prominence in the military industrial complex who were saying that there is a possibility of a balloon gap, which yeah. again, like, it's just like, you know, like, I'm sorry, if your worry is the United States is falling behind in, you know, rubber inflatables, then, you know, like, what have we come to?
it is farcical. I mean, you know, there's a lot going on here. I think this kind of threat inflation is good for a lot of people. It's good for people's political careers. It's good for people who don't have much of a particular political message. You need to fill it in with something. You know, having a foreign bogeyman is always useful for that. It's useful to a lot of people who would stand to make a lot of money from heightened tensions with China. But yeah, I mean, I think it's also psychologically, there is an element to this. You know, it has been said many times before that the United States kind of needs some sort of galvanizing mission, needs some sort of foreign threat to sort of spur itself on. Of course, you had the Cold War with the Soviet Union through the 20th century, which did that. Once the Cold War ended, what happened? There was this kind of period of listlessness for 10 years where it was kind of like, well, what are we really doing? We, you know, maybe we'll go intervene in, you know, Yugoslavia, maybe we'll go to Somalia, you know, but it didn't, there was no sort of cohesive reasoning for what US foreign policy was, and people were kind of adrift. And then you had September 11, and the war on terror became the kind of galvanizing cause of not just US foreign policy, but domestic policy. And I mean, just think about the way that you know, the war on terror really seeped into every part of American life, I think, over those 20 years. And now I think, as you very astutely point out there, clearly there's almost a hope that now China can provide this this kind of galvanizing a threat, outside threat, to restore, well, you know, to put it maybe a little provocatively, to make America great again. yes. And to me, it's not a coincidence that a lot of this stuff is happening. We're seeing tensions ratchet up around the same time that, unfortunately, the broken political system in the United States means that effectively the once ambitious agenda of the Biden administration that was meant to kind of, you know, restore America to greatness and show that democracy can still work and so on and so forth, all these great ideals, which I, you know, agree with in theory, it's blocked because of partisan gridlock in Washington and because of the large-scale corruption that reigns, unfortunately, in the U.S. political system. And so now you don't have that vehicle. You can't seem to get Republicans on board with just, you know, basic common sense measures to expand the U.S. welfare state, to make life easier for working people. And so it seems to me like the hope as well, if we point to China and the threat China poses, as much as we did once upon a time during the Cold War, maybe we can use that as a kind of rhetorical catalyst or a cudgel by which we can kind of move things in direction politically. I mean, that's, you know, all this talk of onshoring and you know, investing in not just green energy here, but also microchips and all that stuff. It's all being kind of sold as a countermeasure against China. You know, which I think reflects that. But ironically, I don't actually think, even if Americans' views of China has really soured over the last few years, because how can it not, given the amount of kind of negativity and sort of, you know, overblown reporting and threat inflation that we talked about towards the country, even as that opinion has soured, Competition with China is not, and you know what, how to deal with the quote unquote China problem is not the leading priority for most Americans. You can look at that in almost any poll that's taken of what Americans think is the most important thing. You know, for them, the main thing is still the economy, inflation. It's things like immigration, gun violence, climate change, of course, healthcare, reforming the healthcare sector. And so I'm skeptical of how useful this is actually going to be for that end, you know, using China as a way to kind of sell a renewal of the American welfare state, or you know, trying to create some sort of American social democracy. It seems like all that's happened is it hasn't done that at all, but what it has done is completely pointlessly ratchet up tensions between these, you know, the two largest economies in the world, and actually, if anything, makes the possibility of economic catastrophe for the average American much more likely. Because I mean, if hostilities between the US and China break out, I mean, that is going to be absolutely terrible for the economy in the US domestically. So, yeah.
No, absolutely. I don't think one can sort of see a strategy here, but it's hard to see how it would actually work in practice. I mean, it is the case that like the only time the US system is, you know, really effective in like getting stuff done is in a wartime mobilization, either the World Wars or in the Cold War. But you know, I don't think you can necessarily just will something that like that into existence. And yeah, I don't think it's going to solve any of these sort of, you know, domestic polarization or division. So but perhaps there's much more one could say about the dangers of a US-China conflict, but I think we've covered a lot of ground. I want to thank once again Ranko Marchtich of Jacobin Magazine for both his excellent piece he wrote on Havana Syndrome and also for unpacking a little bit of this about what exactly is going on with this.
Thanks very much for having me.